good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of It's Easy Son, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. And I must say today, for the second time, I'm having one of my IEM colleagues from Harvard of 2015, Graduate School of Education, with me today, a gentleman that I met when I was in upstate New York. He was in upstate New York as well. And, you know, as fate would have it, after 2015 and the Michael Brown incident and all that happened on the campus of Ithaca College, it was great to see, to have somebody I could reach out to and say, hey, can you stop by my campus and share your expertise, your knowledge around the topic of race, diversity, and inclusion? And quite frankly, this guest came and knocked it out the park. Some of the ideas that he gave, I used in his luncheon sessions that I was doing. And quite frankly, to see his career take off the way it has in this space, I'm not the least bit surprised. So, ladies and gentlemen, today I have a friend and colleague on the show, none other than Mr. Kevin McDonald, who's currently the vice president. I don't know the full title. He'll give us a title, but I'm going to say he's the chief diversity officer. The titles switch all over the country. But as we get into our talk today, you'll get to see a very deep brother, a gentleman that I watched transform lives of young people, even down to the way he dresses and the things that he has done for young African-American males in terms of how they present themselves. It's a pleasure to have him on the show today. So without any further ado, I welcome to the podcast this week my good friend, Dr. Kevin McDonald. Dr. McDonald, how are you doing, sir?
I am well, Brother Gerald. How are you, man? It's great to be on with you. I've been watching the posts of these different podcasts and speakers, so I'm honored to have been invited to be on with everybody.
No, listen, it's an honor for me to have you. And as we go through this conversation and folks see and hear the work that you are doing and that you have done, they'll understand that my brother, you're doing an awesome work in a time in our country, our world, whatever it may be, that this topic needs to be discussed and carried forward. So let's just jump right in. As you might have known, I don't ask a lot of questions. I ask open-ended questions, and based on your responses, I'll have further questions, and before you know it, an hour will be gone. So let's just jump right in. So who is Dr. Kevin McDonald? His early years, his grounding, his family. What undergirds Kevin McDonald today?
Yeah, man. I'm a father, a husband. I'm an only child born of island parents. My father's from Jamaica. My mother's from Bermuda. And on her side, my grandfather's from Barbados, grandmother from Trinidad. And for some odd reason, as many West Indians do, they chose to settle in cold Cleveland, Ohio, which is where I was born. They didn't even have me born on a plane flying over for dual citizenship. So I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, man. But really appreciated that kind of island upbringing, man, pushed me hard. Instilled in me the value of kind of drive, determination, lifting as you climb, pouring into others as others pour into you. And, you know, I've taken that with me for much of my career. I will say my parents went to college and both received advanced degrees, but that didn't stop us from having to kind of engage with adversity. And so I always tell people about the importance of kind of adversity, learning from those experiences, gaining from that what it is for you to gain that helps you identify kind of the destiny that's before you, right? And for me, it was getting evicted from our home when I was 16, man. I remember back from school and seeing some police at what I thought was a neighbor's home, but the closer I got, I realized they were mine. And come to find out my father made some bad business decisions and hadn't paid our mortgage in a while. And we were getting evicted from our home. And I remember sitting and contemplating life in a roach infested Red Roof Inn for like 6 months, man. And, you know, just saying, I never want my family, whenever that would happen, you know, my future family to ever feel what this felt like, and that I would do everything I can to just learn from the experience, man, grow and do the best that I could to support my family and, you know, to be able to be open and honest and vulnerable about my own adversity, as it was really just another life lesson for life. But, you know, took that with me to college and then law school at The Ohio State University, and got my doctoral degree at the University of Rochester. But, you know, but along those way, man, you know, you have twists and turns. I came out of law school not knowing what I wanted to do, but knowing that I didn't want to work in a family firm, which was in East Orange, New Jersey, and they were doing a lot of personal injury and divorce law, and that didn't resonate with me. So I kind of became like the black sheep of the family, because I kind of said, look, I don't think this is for me, and had a cousin in Maryland in medical school, fell in love with the Maryland, D.C. area, but I was engaged to be married, and convinced my wife to be that Maryland was the land of opportunity. So the deal was, if you can find a job, my wife, who had been married before and had a son of the product of that marriage, they said they'd move out there. If not, I had to move back to Columbus, Ohio. And I said, okay, that's easy. That should be easy for me. But it took a minute, Gerald. I was, it took me about 7 months, and I was becoming discouraged, man. And I never forget, I was going to put in a application to a manager in training for 84 Lumber, because I wanted to get some work, and something just told me to hold off, wait one more day. And when I got back, there was a voicemail on those old voicemail machines that we had, right? And it was an invitation to interview for the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division Disability Rights Section, investigating complaints of discrimination under the ADA. And that, for me, is really what launched my career in the field of kind of diversity, equity, inclusion, initially from compliance. But the last thing I'll say is that job didn't have benefits. And so I was a contract employee. My wife said, well, what happens if we get sick? And I said, well, that wasn't the deal. The deal was I was supposed to just find a job. I did that. But as you can imagine, I didn't win that argument. So I found another job, and it was a great job. I was resolving disputes at the dawn of the internet between trademark holders and domain name registrants. It was for the company that registered all the .com, .net, .org names. But I was one of two people that did that for disputes all over the world. And I was waking up, you know, going into work at 6 a.m, coming home at night after 9. And that really wasn't conducive for a healthy newlywed marriage. And so my wife, if she would hear, would say, I owe my entire career in higher education to her, because she found my next job, which was at the University of Maryland in College Park, in the newspaper, when we were still looking in the newspaper, the Washington Times. And she told me to apply, man. Even when I was nervous about the whole higher ed, you know, interview process and open forum, she kind of pulled me up and said, you were built for this. You can do this. I fell in love with higher education. I was offered the job, and I've been in higher education ever since.
So let me ask you a question, because I always like to take folks all the way back. What you just shared with us is amazing, but the role that you have now, obviously we'll get to that in a minute and how you got to where you are today. When you were young coming up, what did you want to be, or who did you want to be when you were young? Say,
yeah,
grade school, middle school, going through the Cleveland, Ohio school system.
Yeah.
You know, you had this Caribbean upbringing. What did you want to be?
Yeah, you know, I was a bit defiant, and because my father, you know, my father was an accountant. He had in his mind what he wanted me to do. And it was, you know, either be an accountant, be a doctor, lawyer, something. And I think I wanted him to affirm and approve of whatever I wanted to be, as long as I did it to the best of my abilities. So I would always tell my dad, and it would frustrate him and make him upset to no end, that I wanted to be a grocery store bagger, right? I would just say, I'm going to be a grocery store bagger. Yeah, I said, yeah. Dad, I'm going to be the best grocery store bagger I can be. And I just wanted him to say, whatever you want to do, do it to your best ability. And man, it would made him so mad. And so I didn't really, because I was doing that, I didn't really focus on what I really wanted to be. I'll be honest with you. But one of the things I've done with my own kids is tell them, listen, don't think I have some preconceived notion of what I want you to be. I just don't want you to half step it. Whatever you want to do, just do it with the drive, determination, with the tenacity, you know, that you know, our family kind of requires, right? And then just do, you know, and be happy. But I always tell people, whatever you do, if you can find the intersection of your passion and your purpose, then you will never feel like you're working a day in your life. You know what I mean? I do feel like I've fallen into that. Like I wake up every day excited because I feel like I have the ability to impact the lives of people. And that's all I try to do with the best, to the best of my ability. But I'll be honest with you, I did not know that coming up. I didn't know that because I had so many people telling me what they wanted me to be and not really helping me explore what the opportunities were that were out there. So even in higher education, when I hear and people talk about STEM and all that stuff, I didn't know about engineering growing up. I didn't know about all of those opportunities. And so I'm a firm believer in exposure, right? Just exposing young people so that they can find a sweet spot, you know what I mean? And so they can find that intersection. Because I didn't have that. And I feel fortunate that I found it, but not everybody does.
You know what's amazing to me? All the guests that I've had on, as accomplished as everybody is, no one seemed to have hit it, with the exception of about two or three, I should say. Starting out to where they are today is not where they were when they started out. All they knew is their parents said to them that education was, you know, it's not an option to not be educated. That was the ground rule. And then everything kind of meandered after that. So me knowing you as a scholar, not only in this space, but attorney, all this kind of stuff, to hear you say that, I'm always surprised by that because I see you guys and what you do. But focused, driven, I would have always thought that, hey, from grade school or middle school or high school, you guys were on it. You know, just this is what I want to do.
You know what? It's funny you say that because even in grade school, I remember, man, I was probably up until about to the fifth grade, I was a bit of a knucklehead. You know what I mean? Meaning that I was smart. I would apply myself at times, but I was also an impressionable young man. And, you know, sometimes I was the jokester. So I was kind of going with the crowd. And I never forget, man, I don't remember all of my teachers. But there was a fifth grade teacher by the name of Patricia Benkar, man, at Caledonia. And I never forget, she pulled me aside. She hemmed me up in the closet and said, listen, you're not like what you're portraying. You're not like the rest of these young people out here acting a fool. I know that you're trying to be something you're not. And there is something better for you and you need to get it together or you're going to miss it. I mean, man, brought tears to my eyes. I never had anyone call me out like that, man. And when I tell you from that moment on, I straightened up and flew right. Like, I mean, I really wanted to do it for me and I really wanted to do it for her because she was one of the few people outside of family who said, I see you and I believe in you. There's a purpose for your life. There's destiny for your life. Walk into it, but you can't do it the way you're doing it. You're on the wrong path, my brother. And so I really appreciate that. And I think that's why I'm so passionate about young people and pouring into them. And no matter what the world has said and characterized them to be, no matter what, you know, life has thrown their way, no matter what disparities currently exist, I always believe that people can overcome them.
Yeah, absolutely. So that teacher, fifth grade teacher, Ms. Benacourt, you said?
Yeah, Benkar.
Yeah. Benkar. So that was, is that a flashpoint for you? Because that carried you through high school and college. So lawyer, coming out of high school, coming out of college, you said your passion and your purpose.
Yeah. So
coming through high school, going into college, what drove you at that point?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to do well. I knew that. And it's so funny. I had a family dentist that had taken a liking to me and said, man, you seem like a good young man. You seem like you're working hard. I think you should go into dentistry. And he said, if you go to college and take these requisite courses, go to dental school, you can come back and take over my practice in Cleveland, Ohio. Wow. And I said, man, and he was doing well. I mean, I said, Gerald, I said, well, good. Shoot, my whole life has already been planned out. I'm good to go. So I went into college thinking I had it on lock, man. But one huge problem was that the sciences and I just didn't get along, man. I mean, right. I took my initial courses. I went in there like, I don't know about the rest of y'all, but I'm going to be a dentist. I got everything lined up. And, man, I mean, biology, chemistry, I was just not doing well. And so I remember having to call the dentist and tell him, gosh, I really thank you for seeing something in me. I don't think this is the right field for me. And now I need to do some homework to see what the right field is. And so I went going to the library, talking to career counselors and, you know, them having me kind of take little self-assessments. And it was starting to point me in a direction of law, you know, saying, gosh, you are passionate about equal opportunity issues, civil rights issues. You believe strongly about points and social issues. You would be a good lawyer. And I was like, okay, great. Well, then this is point. And you could have any degree to go to law school. And so I said, great. I can just kind of tweak my health psych, which is what I was doing, to basic psychology, because I still like psychology, and I can go to law school. And that's what I did. I finally, you know, again, kind of said, okay, Kevin, no one's just, it's not like as easy as taking a pill. You're going to do this. So you actually got to do some work, figure this out. But once I did that, I wasn't deterred. I felt like that was the right path for me. Yeah. And that's really what got me on the path to law school.
Wow. And then undergrad was where?
At Andrews University. And that in and of itself is a funny story, because I said that my parents, you know, were college educated, and but they didn't tell me when I was applying to college that you should apply to, you know, a few schools. And so I only applied to one, which was Northwestern, and I got waitlisted. And I was like, okay, what do I do now? Like, I don't know what to do now. I put all my eggs in one basket. And my mother was like, well, yeah, I heard about this other school through one of my girlfriends, and it's called Andrews University. It's in Barron Springs, Michigan. Why don't you go there? And I said, all right, I don't know anything about it, but I'll go there. And then I'm going to transfer to Northwestern after a year, and I end up going there and really enjoying it. And it was a much smaller school, like 2,000 students, but ended up loving it. And I stayed there all 4 years. But again, even that, you know, I was supposed to be there. But even that was something that I stumbled upon.
Yeah. Wow, that is amazing. So what, you put all your eggs in one basket, but you made it out all right, my brother.
I made it out all right. But I always tell students when they apply, I said, please make sure you have your safe schools, your this school, your that, you know. But don't do what I did, you know, learn from my experience. Yeah.
So you completed Andrews. Was it a straight leap to law school at Ohio State?
It was my own kind of conversation with myself to say, okay, you could go out and work a little bit, or you could go straight through. And my biggest fear, quite honestly, was, you know, there were some pros to doing that, like you can gain some maturity and a number of things. But I was worried that I was going to start working and making a little money and wouldn't want to go to law school. And so I just said, you know what, let's just keep going. I finished this. Let's push through. So that's what I did. I went straight into law school, which is very different, by the way, then when I went back for my doctoral degree. I was married with kids. And the only reason I went back for my doctoral degree wasn't because I had a love of learning, was because as I was kind of navigating institution to institution, they were saying, gosh, Kevin, you're really good and really promotable. We see some great things in your future if only you had a terminal degree. So they didn't look at my law degree as a terminal degree. And so I said, really? So I was hitting these ceilings, you know, and couldn't help but thinking that my own kind of race might have been playing a part in it. And so I said, okay, I'm going to go back and get this doctoral degree, and then I have both. Then what? You know what I mean? And that's exactly what I did. So it really was with that intent. It was no other desire at all but to stop, to try to use a tool that would not enable people to kind of block opportunities for me.
Right. Well, that's interesting, because I knew you were a lawyer. The doctoral part, for some reason, I thought it was a full terminal, or is it an EDD?
It's an EDD. So it started out as a PhD. I was at sociology with African studies at Virginia Tech, but then I got recruited to Rochester Institute of Technology.
Yeah. Okay.
And to get the same degree would have been at the University of Buffalo, and it was going to be an hour drive, and I was worried about the snow. So I transferred to the University of Rochester, which had an EDD in higher education leadership.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I'm glad our paths crossed, because, you know, it's always great to learn about people that you have met and you see their work, but understanding their journey is always interesting to me. But As I look at your career in higher ed, all the meanderings you made, you know, the 84 lumber and all these things you just shared, undergrad psychology, law degree, doctoral degree, you are one of the probably best DEI officers in the higher education space, bar none. That's my personal opinion, based on the work I've seen you do. All of those steps, Andrews, Ohio State, and Rochester, for example, do you think that they prepared you for what you're doing now, or going back to what people saw in you to say, deal with law, meaning that this thing and passion you have for people was innately in you and just brought out by your journey?
Yeah, I think the way they prepared me was from the standpoint of the necessary pedigree just to get the doors open. But I actually think what has allowed me to ascend has been really a relationships building quality that I think people saw in me, right? That I value the importance of relationships with people at all levels, man. And I'm unapologetic in that. So, you know, I'm never going to act brand new with somebody. They know if they call, I'm going to answer. It doesn't matter where you are at the university, what position you hold. Every relationship is important for me, and I guard it and engage with it like gold. I want people to, you know, finish having a meeting with me feeling not that they had a meeting, but that they had an experience. And I just think that has really been incredibly helpful, because I'm engaged and remain engaged. And I think you have to be in this work to be, you know, to be successful. I think you have to be thoughtful. You have to be open, honest, transparent. I think you can't overpromise and underdeliver. I think you definitely have to have vision, but you also have to believe in co-creation, that you can't have all the answers, right? But you have to kind of identify partners to build as well. And I've that has been my MO wherever I've gone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, regardless of whether the situation was a new build or something being born out of a crisis, you know, or going into wonderfully just supportive place, I use the same approach every time. And I think that's really has been my recipe for success. I never become intoxicated by the position. I'm grateful and humble to be in that role, to be a servant leader. And then one thing that a president told me that I also take in is, he said, always act like you've been there before. Don't act like someone did you a favor by giving you this opportunity. You were supposed to be there, right? So I'm confident in my abilities, not to the point of arrogance, but confidence that I am put on this earth to do this work, and I want to do it to the best of my ability, but I want to honor it. And to honor it, I have to be authentic with my relationships. And so it's a relationship building aspect to me that has been just probably single-handedly the most important thing that I take with the job.
So before we got on the recording, I shared with you our pamphlet from IEM. It was about 99 of us. I don't know how we didn't get to 100. It was 99 of us. And we see, you know, people like Zachary is now our president. And we had a couple of our colleagues from that class are now presidents. I look at you, you say, you know, looking at you in your career, you're presidential in your appearance. Is that something that you ever think about? Does that ever resonate that in the back of your mind?
Yeah, you know, from time to time, and I think people also see it in me, and so I feel incredibly honored when people say that, and I'm appreciative of that. You know what I do? I am quite honestly, Gerald, I'm just prayerful about it, and I think if those opportunities rise and that is in the path for me, then I would be honored. But for me, I recognize that those have to be the right situations, and I am not trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, and I want if that opportunity were to present itself for an institution to really believe that I'm the right person for it, given my own background. I believe that I could serve in that role well, but I also recognize if it may not be in the cards for me, and if that's the case, I'm just incredibly grateful for the career I've had thus far, and open to wherever wherever that path may lead for me next, whether it remains in adversity or, you know, it goes into some other space or it's in a private sector. You know, I was one of the youngest vice presidents when I was at Virginia Tech. And I remember when I got there, I was like, man, now I'm in this role. Now what? This was always my aspiration. Now I've reached it. Now what? So I don't set those goals anymore. I kind of just say, I want to really just do good work. I want to be in a position to do good work. I think I can do that as a president. I think I can do that as a VP. But I just want to be in a work to do that, do good work. And I want to be in a space where I'm given the latitude to be creative and innovative. That's the biggest thing for me, Gerald. Once I lose that ability, once someone tries to control that or micromanage that or stifle that, I can't wake up every day excited about the opportunity. Right. And that's me, the driver, because I just believe I can work and interact with anybody to create an enhanced result. But if that's taken away, my passion is taken away. So I may still be in my purpose, but I'm not at the intersection of my passion. And so I'm not effective anymore. So I just think that whatever I do, I want to still be able to do that. And if it's in the plan for me to be a president, I would welcome that with open arms. But if not, I'm also incredibly content with these opportunities that I've been given to impact the communities that I'm a part of.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned good work. You've done quite a bit of good work, and I definitely would want to hear the background and the story of when you were at RIT and that group you formed for the young Black males in the community, the suits, the dressing. How did that come into being? That's not part of your role, but you ended up doing this in the community in the city of Rochester and the environs. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So in Rochester, Rochester right now, I think is first in the nation in concentrated poverty. When I was there, it was number two. Graduation rates were 42%, but only 5% and 9% for African-American and Latinx males. And I remember sitting on a student success steering committee, and they were looking at data that was showing us that women were outperforming men, and they wanted to create an overarching male initiative. And I said, man, I think this has implications for young men of color, particularly at PWIs. And they were also really excited about a new scholarship program called the Rochester City Scholarship Program. Many institutions, after the legal decisions of the kind of race-based cases in Michigan, Gratz Grutter, were looking to create scholarship programs based on socioeconomic status to kind of still increase diversity. But the students were not faring that great. They lacked some of the support mechanisms needed. And so I said, man, I think that there is an opportunity here for us. Let me research what's happening nationally in this space. And I think I might have an idea. Talk to some young men and pitch this idea for a program that we would call MOCA. I wanted to have something that was catchy and recognizable and could be put on paraphernalia. And so MOCA stands for Men of Color, Honor, and Ambition. It's open to students regardless of race or ethnicity, but it has been specifically created through the lens of young men of color, which I think is another thing that differentiates it. You could have a white student that goes through it as long as that white student understands the experience that they're going through. And that was intentional. And it's thinking about how we started this conversation with stories. It's really based on everything I wish I had in college, but didn't, right? And so quite honestly and selfishly, but it really is just based on kind of exposure for these young people. And on any given day, Gerald, they might have gone through personal finance, personal branding, networking, community service, health and wellness on any given day. They might do heated yoga or CrossFit. So it was amazing to see. And then one of our greatest partnerships was with Dale Carnegie. Dale Carnegie had been a strong franchise in Rochester. They've been providing C-suite level, executive level workshops. And I thought it had implications for young men to prepare them, because one of the things we were hearing from business organizations was that, you know, a lot of the students coming out of tech schools were lacking the interpersonal communication skills. So we partnered with Dale Carnegie, and we just saw the confidence levels of these students go through the roof. And then at the end of the experience, if they participated at a high level, we provided them with tailor-made suits, shirts, ties, shoes. And one of the reasons for that was because I would go to a career fair And I would see that many of our students of color were not dressed appropriately. And so I just said, hey, what's going on? And many of them said, I don't own one. I don't own a suit. You know, I would love to do it. I don't own a suit. And I said, well, what if you had a suit? Would that take some of the guesswork out of it and allow you to prepare more for the interview itself? And they said, oh, that would be awesome. So I just made a mental note to myself. And I said, if I was in a position, we would build that into the program. And so we did that, man. And the students started outperforming the general population of students. And then when they graduated, they started getting hired by companies like Intel and Google and JP Morgan Chase and Apple. And I remember Disney flew me out because they were like, man, we heard about this MOGA program. And that's what a number of them were saying. They said, look, we're hiring these students as first year associates and they're outperforming our other first year associates. And it's not even close. And it doesn't matter if those first year associates came from an Ivy League or not. And so we've asked these students where to find more like them because they look the part, they have great confidence, they're prepared. And they told us about this MOGA program. So can you tell us more about it? And that's when I said, man, we might have something here. So those students were going off and doing good things. And when the president retired at RIT, and I started thinking about what my next phase of my journey would be, and I ended up going out to the Missouri system. We implemented the program there in the University of Missouri system at four campuses, and then we added in an HBCU, Lincoln University, in Jefferson City. And then I said, man, if this thing works in college, could it work in high school? And so we launched it in three different high school districts in Missouri, Kansas City, Columbia, and then Jeff City. And it just took off, man. We had Kansas City grew it to like 200 students.
Wow.
Same thing was happening now. We didn't give them tailor-made suits because we felt that they were still growing, but we partnered with Men's Warehouse and they got those suits from there. So when I came out to Charlottesville, you know, there were some leadership development programs at University of Virginia, so I didn't want to compete with that. And I just went to the community and said, hey, where's the greatest need? And they said in middle school. And so I said, okay. So we launched it in middle school, and Dale Carnegie has still been our partner. So Dale Carnegie has given their executive level workshops to high schoolers and middle schoolers now.
Wow.
And so it's been really an awesome experience, man. I'm excited about it. For me, it is one of the biggest pride points for me. I just love pouring into these young people. And right now, because of the pandemic, we're doing it virtually. So that in and of itself has challenges, but these young people have been hanging with us, man. And I just look forward to building it. And we have a corresponding one that my colleagues built out in Rochester that I have adopted other places called WOCA for young women, women of color, honor, and ambition. So they're doing well in Rochester. We created it as well in Missouri at the collegiate and high school level. And we're doing it now as well in the middle school and high school level here in Charlottesville, man. So I'm excited about it. That is the one of the things, man, I commit my weekend time to just to support these young people. And it's been one of the greatest. In fact, one of the greatest things was I still follow many of these young men. And one of them is a Latinx brother that, you know, I connected with, just asked him how he's doing. He went on to go to Tufts for graduate school. And I said, man, what's going on next? What's next for you? And he said, man, I want to start my own venture capitalist firm.
Wow.
To give back to Black and brown communities. I mean, I just, and he said, I would have never have done this, would have never accomplished any of this if it wasn't for you believing in us and pouring into us in the MOCA program. And that for me, man, hands down, just, you know, I got other brothers going on getting their MBAs, you know, from Northwestern, others doing, I mean, it's just so great to see, man. And so I feel like I'm going to do this till I retire, maybe till they put me in the grave, but it is one of the things that I'm most passionate about.
Yeah. Well, my brother, I'm watching your body language and your facial expressions. And I know from the first time you told me about it, it's something that was near and dear to your heart, but to hear that you took it with you to Missouri and now in the middle school in Charlottesville, that's amazing. But I have to give you a shout out though. The first tailored suits that I had, you recommended the tailor for me, Adrian Jules, right? So my first two ever tailored suits with my name in the jacket, you recommended them.
Wow.
Up in Rochester. And I moved now, so I don't actually get to use them anymore. But if anything, my brother, you impacted me as well, just to let you know that.
And you know, Adrian Jules was our major partner in Rochester, man. And it was so amazing because they became so invested in the program. You won't believe this, but they created their own mocha line of suits
that the
community could come in and purchase, and a percentage of which they would give back to the program.
Wow.
That's how it was influenced. I mean, that to me, man, it just said it all. So,
and yeah. I met the dad. Obviously, yeah. I went in, I met the son, and then I was like, wow. Then the dad was in one day. I saw him measuring, you know, like he was actually making a suit almost. So I got to meet the family in that way. But you know, thank you for that. Those suits,
absolutely,
they fit well. So when you think about your career now and all of what you have accomplished and the space that you work in, the nation is kind of in a place. You've been working in this space. You know, you're still a young man. I think we're around the same age or close to. And we kind of do this work because we want to leave an impact in some ways, right? We want to help people because a lot of people helped us. But now in this diversity and equity space, what do you see are the challenges in the higher education setting, given the demographic shifts in the nation, which brings along with it the socioeconomic shift as well? What are you doing now in this space that is strategy based as you see us kind of in this pivot that people are still trying to figure out?
Yeah, man, I would say a lot of my work, man, has been really focused a lot on organizational journeys, you know, like the movement of diversity, equity, inclusion from the periphery of the moral imperative of doing this because it's the right thing to do. I mean, that's important, but also kind of embedding that within much more of a metric-driven organizational structure approach that looks at data disaggregated to see what story it's telling us that compels us to action in areas of affirmation and areas of opportunity. And I will tell you, what a blessing. I feel very fortunate. This is kind of, I think, my seventh higher ed move, man. For the University of Missouri, I actually had two roles. One got added, and I was at the system, and then I got the flagship campus, so I count those two roles. So my seventh higher ed role, I never regret any move. I've learned and grown everywhere I've gone and been so appreciative of the opportunity. And the reason I say that is because I mentioned that, you know, now I'm doing a lot of focus on organizational work and strategic work around diversity, equity, inclusion, particularly utilizing the inclusive excellence framework. And up until Missouri, I had really focused on the institutions that I was in, which has been awesome. And I felt like that's what you do, right? You work on the organization and its own organizational plan. But when I got to Missouri, I was taken out to lunch one day after I had implemented, kind of helped work to develop and co-create an inclusive excellence framework for the University of Missouri system. But I was taken out to lunch maybe 6 months after being there. And it was like CEOs of banks and heads of banks and the mayor of Columbia, superintendent of schools, head of the Chamber of Commerce and others, man. And they wanted to, they pitched it as this get to know you luncheon. So I go there at this beautiful bank for this lunch. And they said, listen, Kevin, you know, it's great to get to know you, but we also want to share something with you. And when the protests happened here in 2015, we were chagrined because we really wanted to roll up our sleeves and work with the university to change what was a growing negative national narrative, right, around DEI in the whole entire state of Missouri. In fact, the NAACP had issued a travel advisory ban for the entire state of Missouri, right? Don't crawl, don't walk, don't fly because into Missouri because it's so bad with regard to race. And so they said, when we tried to reach out to the University of Missouri, they rebuffed our efforts because they wanted to keep their stuff in-house. They were maybe embarrassed about what happened and they didn't want to work. So they said, we want to get to know you for sure, but we won't let you leave this lunch until you give us a bold idea on how we could do that since we were not able to accomplish it. And Gerald, I didn't have any ideas, man. I was just trying to enjoy this lunch. And I said, well, how do I get out of here relatively unscathed? And so in between bites of salad, man, I said, well, you all, I mentioned this inclusive excellence framework that we had done at University of Missouri system. I said, here's a bold idea. Never thought of. I'm thinking off the top of my head. So, you know, shoot it down if you don't think it's a good idea. I said, but what if we rewrote that framework, removed all the higher ed references and allowed it to serve as a backdrop for our entire city and our county? What if we created a shared narrative, a framework that we all could share, we could share and talk about and, you know, strategize around recruitment and retention, dual career assistance, all this stuff. And they didn't laugh me out the room. They thought that it had merit. And Gerald, it just took off. It just exploded. We had over 100 companies develop their own inclusive excellence plan. They created this passport journey for community members. 1,000 people signed up for it. We had cities like Chicago, Lafayette, Louisiana, Knoxville, Tennessee, and Athens, Georgia send contingents to little old Columbia, Missouri, because they heard about it and wanted to replicate it in their cities with anchor institutions. So when I moved out to Charlottesville, this community said, man, after 2017, what happened here? We've been rocked to our core. We think it's high time now that we move beyond our silos and work collaboratively to move this work forward. Do you have any ideas? And I said, you know, I don't know if this would have any bearing here. Every community is different, but this is what happened in Columbia, and it was beautiful. And they said, you know what? That might have merit. Meet with this organizational leader, this community leader. Let us know what you think. And it started to gain momentum. We had United Way adopted and the Charlottesville City School District. And we had a senior living retirement community adopted, right? But then I had a chance meeting with my counterpart at the state. Her name is Janice Underwood. And she said, listen, it's great to meet you. Let me know if you have any ideas, because I'm being charged with creating a strategic framework for state agencies. And I said, well, why stop at state agencies? Why don't we just do something that's unprecedented and do it for the entire state of Virginia, for the entire Commonwealth? And lo and behold, if the governor did not adopt our inclusive excellence framework that we just brought to Virginia for the entire state of Virginia. So for me, man, I live in this space, Gerald, that we have not because we ask not. Nothing is unattainable. Nothing. There is nothing that cannot be reached as long as we have the vision, the ingenuity, the innovation, and the relationship building skills to be able to share it in a way that people can receive it, their pores of receptivity are most open. And I'll be honest with you, that thing has been exploding, man. People have been hearing about it and just asking me to share. And so I've done it with a venture capitalist firm. We developed it for national 4-H. So all of the national 4-H across the nation is now using the inclusive excellence framework. I had a meeting with the Club Association Managers of America. They represent all country clubs in the nation. They heard about the framework, go figure, and they wanted to be shared. So I think it's just the approach, you know, right. And I think we've created it in such a way that it's just, we share that it can be adaptable to any organizational type. And that's what has allowed people to be most receptive. Even we have an economic development consortium in the area that has said, oh, we love it. We do it. So it's been cool. I'm kind of riding the wave, and I'm again, just grateful for the opportunity to serve others, man. And just share the message. Last week, I did it for the Virginia Nurses Association Conference. They specifically wanted me to deliver a keynote on inclusive excellence framework. So it's been cool. I just met with CHEV, the governing body for all the state schools. Yeah. And they're utilizing inclusive excellence framework. It's crazy, man.
My brother, let me tell you something. I think that you are flowing in your gift and your purpose. It's always a pleasure because I follow you on LinkedIn and we're friends on Facebook, etc. But whenever I look at your posts are not necessarily about just your institution. It is about the broader DEI. And there's something that my audience wouldn't know, but you mentioned 2015 and 2017. 2015 was Michael Brown. 2017 was the whole Tiki Torch thing and all that stuff. You have gone in after all of those instances to major institutions, University of Missouri, UVA, now where you're currently there. Now, you said something earlier that caught my ear, but I didn't want it to go by. Build versus, I think you said restore. Is there a difference between the two in your mind?
Yeah, part of it for me is build is some, I've been in situations where they had no vision around what DEI should look like. And so it wasn't funded. I mean, you go in and you, at RIT, man, I was in office of three people with a $59,000 budget, right? And I told, I told, for any of your listeners that remember the old MacGyver shows, I said, I feel like I'm in a cruel episode of MacGyver. Like, you've given me a stick of gum and a wrap, and you want me to create a door. I said, I don't know what to do with that. But I said, and not everybody can do this, but I love betting on myself, Gerald. And so I said to the president, I said, let me ask you to do me a favor. Let me spend what I can spend in 3 years, and you just take that, the mean of that, right? But let me show you what I can do. And here's one other thing I said to him. I said, if there is any underperforming unit, right, that you've just not been pleased with and you want to give it a new home, let me show you what I'll do with this first unit that he gave me, an underperforming unit. I said, let me show you what I can do with that. And if you're happy with that, I believe I can take any underperforming unit and turn that lemon into lemonade. Mm-hmm. And Gerald, mark my words, I started with 3 people. When I left there, I was a division of 35, right? Wow. And these were not new hires. These were existing units. Yep. That the president, once we turned one unit around, the president was like, okay, all right, well, let's see what you can do with this one and with this one. And so I love that. So that was, for me, was the build. I was building, I really felt like I was building something from scratch. And from a restore standpoint or a rebuild, it is a crisis that has rocked an organization to its core that it may have never valued diversity, or maybe it did in some way, or it thought it did, but it was actually asking to be not just restored, but improved right upon. And they're asking you to come in. And when I tell you, I don't think there was anyone that was interested in that University of Missouri position. I mean, I had a mentor, the president of RIT said, Kevin, you've made good decisions in your career, but I think this one is going to be a career killer. So I trusted his judgment as much as anyone. And I said, I would laugh. I said, man, that's a long continuum, you know, for you to go all the way to career killer. Like, but I also believed in myself, man. And I, once I went to that community, I said, wait a minute, what they want is what I can provide, right? The community basically said, we want someone, we want a party. We want someone who can engage with us, who will be authentic and transparent in ways that administration has never been. The students said the protest didn't just happen. They said they've been trying to have conversations with the administration for 2 years prior to the protest, but to no avail. So I knew I could do that. I could engage early and often. So that was the important thing for me with Missouri. The other thing was, I also recognized that they couldn't go anywhere but up. It wasn't going to get any worse, and that I wasn't going to be seen as part of the problem, but part of the solution. And I could work with those odds. And so again, I just went and I said, I know if I follow the recipe, don't deviate from what has been allowed me to be successful, that I could be successful here. And so I was grateful, you know, for the opportunity. But for me, that's been the differentiation of those type of two spaces.
Well, you know, it's something interesting you just said. And, you know, always good to know good people. You talk about relationships. When I had asked you to come to Ithaca College and President Rashawn, because, you know, we had gone through the whole thing, the spillover from 2015, I never forgot the advice that you gave me, and I've kept it with me everywhere that I've been. Now, I find myself in conversations in the Kubo and all over the place about CFO and DEI work. I'm not a psychologist, sociologist, or whatever kind of ologist. I'm an accountant. I count money, but it's really about the people and having a heart. And as you said, being transparent and things like that. That is something I respect about you, because you definitely, wherever you go, you speak from the heart. And when you leave, you're right. You said something that was rather interesting. You say when people get around you and leave a meeting with you, it's like they have had an experience. They learned something. And I can definitely vouch for that. Well, like I said, we're close to time. The hour is going to run real fast. But given your background and the work that you do, this podcast is what we try to do is to inspire young people. Young, not meaning teenagers and lower. I mean, young professionals who are inside a COVID experience, or young professionals that are seeing the ugliness of what the underbelly of some of the ugliness that can happen in a nation. But we still have to find ways to inspire. You've done that through Mocha and the things that you've done there. But if you were to have any words of inspiration or encouragement, your father, yourself, seeing what you're seeing and the work that you do, what are some words of wisdom or things that folks could anchor on to just see themselves through this phase that we seem to be going through, COVID and all the other stuff?
Yeah, I would say, look, for everybody to know that they have a purpose for their life, that they are here for a reason. It takes much discernment sometimes to figure out what that purpose is, but to continue to remain open to that and to be seeking that. Maybe they've already identified and recognized the purpose, but to find that intersection of their passion and their purpose. The other thing that for me that has been incredibly important for my career is I recognize that sometimes you got to go to grow, kind of knowing when timing is incredibly important. And there could be wonderful opportunities of growth at one institution that you're in. I just didn't have that. And so I recognize that as a young professional who was in a great comfort level of Black professionals in Maryland, D.C., I saw that opportunity to go to grow to Blacksburg, Virginia, that did not have a lot of people who looked like me, but it was incredibly an important springboard for my career. Missouri, same thing. And so I encourage people to recognize that there may be times that they have to go to grow. For me, the third thing is that I mentioned before, I think adversity is something that you may be going through now. It is a part of our own personal and professional journeys. Continue to see a bright side, right? We are going to get through this pandemic. You are going to get through that adversity and then grow and learn from the experience. For a couple of reasons. One, so that you don't have to go through it maybe again. But two, because I think there's a learning in every experience, right? And then the fourth thing I would say, and I don't think we do enough of this in our own communities in higher education, but I was very fortunate in Maryland to meet some amazing Black faculty and staff who poured into me. I mean, they said when I was early, they said, young blood, let's talk to you. Let us talk to you. They said, If you allow us to, we'd love to be able to pour into you, tell you everything we know about what will allow you to be successful. And we only have one request. We don't ask you to pay it back. We only ask you to pay it forward. And I tell you, Gerald, on this Zoom call today, that's exactly how I've lived my life. I'm still incredibly connected with those people. And I continue to just pour into anyone that will allow me to pour in the way that they have poured into me. And they still pour into me. I mean, yeah. Folks are retired and I check in with them every couple of months, man, just to get some words of wisdom, just to, you know, and I just think that's important, man. Never become so caught up in roles or status or intoxicated by roles that you can't believe that people can pour into you. And also never forget that you have a bigger purpose in your life. And it's not just with the power and control and the influence that you have in your role, it's the ability and the opportunity to lift as you climb and to pour into others. So I think that's an important part of the work that I actually think is one of the greatest Achilles heels of leaders today, that really? They don't do that, that they really? Just don't do that anymore.
Wow.
If you think about it. And so I just think we have to do that. And the key, Gerald, for me is to not discriminate on who you pouring into. That's the key. You know, some leaders may say, well, I'm going to do it if you're in my inner circle. And if I, you know, I pour into anyone that thinks I have some value. And if they think that, and they reach out to me and they ask, I have people reach out to me on LinkedIn, right? And I respond to them and I will set up meetings with them. And even today, still monthly meetings, man, with them. Just if they think I have something to offer, because people did that for me. And in this diversity field, there is not really anyone outside of those mentors who helped me, but no one who helped me become like a CDO. I just had to learn. And so that was hard, man. And so I'm committed to just supporting others that have an interest in this space in ways that I quite honestly didn't have that kind of support. So,
well, my brother, I'll tell you this much. After this interview, when we share this on the platforms and everything and folks hear the story, I've learned a lot more about you today than I've known you now for the last 6 years when we first met up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So we do have a common mutual friend, colleague, and I must say I did have conversations with you before I came down here, and I will say you are spot on in that. And Dr. Cartwright is someone that's a joy to work for. I've been here 4 months now, and just watching him and his humility and how he approaches leading, it's really refreshing. And that's why I said to you just now, when you said enough leaders don't do that, then I said, really, because I've been blessed to be around leaders who pour into others. It was David Thomas at Morehouse Steel, Dorothy Yancey, and so on. But my brother, it's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure spending this time with you. I will give you the last word if there's anything that you want to share that's on your heart or your mind. And I will say this, I am going to find a way to connect with you back offline about Mocha, because I thought it just stayed in Rochester. I didn't know that you had taken it to Missouri and it's now down here in Charlottesville. I have a couple of friends right there in the state of Virginia. A good friend of mine, a former colleague of mine, is at the University of Richmond, who actually started remember the lunch things I did at Ithaca College? I think he started that started something similar at the University of Richmond. He was my chief information officer at Ithaca, Keith McIntosh.
Okay.
I'll probably get him on the show at some point, but yeah. I have to catch up with you, my brother, because that Mocha program can do a lot to inspire. And I didn't know also that it was open to all.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah. It's been awesome, man. You know why? And you know what some of the young men that went through it who were Black and Latinx said? And it was one of the powerful statements, man, to hear from the young people. They said, we're actually glad that it's open to all, because because they help vote the people in, the next cohorts, right? And they interview them. And I remember one year they let three white males in. I said, well, why did you let three white males in? And they said, because we believe we saw through to their heart that they really wanted this experience, right? And the other thing is that one day they're going to be in positions of leadership to hire, and we need them to know the amazing talent that surrounds them in this community. It was powerful, man. In fact, the end of the year awards, you're voted on by your peers, and that year, a white male won the top award in the Mocha program, voted by. And when I tell you, when he accepted the award, he broke down in tears. He said he has had other things in his life. This meant the more to him than anything else. He wanted his family members to know. Now, he had a very unique experience because he lived in Abu Dhabi for most of his life. So, you know, he had an additional kind of diversity lens, but still, to be voted that and to break down in tears, man, that, for me, that's life, man. That's how we should be approaching organizational work. So anyway, the last thing I would say, man, is just an opportunity just to affirm you, brother. I mean, you know, your career has been awesome as well. Ithaca and Cornell and Morehouse and now the University of Central Florida and HBCU before that. And you continue to lead by example, man, and you continue to care about people and this work and to want to get a message out. You have a platform and you're using it, man. So I'm appreciative of what you're doing. I'm appreciative of the lives that you're impacting, man, and you remain as humble and as well-versed as the time when we met in Cambridge. I still use, is the juice worth the squeeze? So I'm just appreciative of all your contributions. And I know that you are going to have an absolutely transformational impact at the University of Central Florida. And look forward to the partnership and strong bond that you're going to form with Alex, because he is he's a good Bahamian leader, man. And I know he cares about this work. And most importantly for me, he cares about people. You really can't go wrong doing that, man. You have some leadership and you also care about people, man. That's a powerful combination.
Yeah, I'm enjoying myself here. Oh, thank you. But you said it best, my brother. I was blessed and fortunate to have people pour into me. And I just thought it would be robbery and selfish if I didn't do the same for others. I try daily, like we all do every day. You never know what your efforts are, but I get up every day trying to figure out how I can help someone along the way, because I was the beneficiary of it. And you, my brother, are a living testimony and walking example of that. And I'm humbled that you joined me today. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've just spent the last hour with Dr. Kevin McDonald. We could be here for about 2 hours because we didn't talk about anything, our experiences and what we went through. Just 2 weeks up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, forming relationships with a lot of higher education leaders, presidents, provosts, board chairs, you name it. It runs the gamut in higher education. So until next week, remember, this is It's Easy, Son. Your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. And until then, take care, be safe, be strong, and be the best that you can be. Until next week, take care. Bye-bye.